This week's podcast is brought to you by our new sponsor or new partnership, LSKD.
Yeah, they're a local Brisbane business who like us, are trying to take over the world. They're obviously a great clothing brand who, you know, as James will attest to, we used to be fully kitted out in Lululemon, but now LSKD's come along and we're jumping on that bandwagon because it's better.
Yeah.
I've just really enjoyed the quality of the clothes. They're a really good brand to work with. They share our values.
Yeah, and we've worked with these to get this going. Like, we wanted this as well, just as much as them. So we're super pumped to have them on board. So by supporting LSKD, you are also supporting us and you are supporting the growth of this podcast. You get 10% off at checkout with the code REBUILD, or you can follow the links in the show notes or go to our social media and click on the links and you will get 10% off with LSKD.
Yeah, we can take care of your training and nutrition, but then let them deck you out and look good in all their clothes.
I'm James Beattie.
And I'm Sean Carroll.
And welcome to the Rebuild Health and Fitness Podcast. All right, and welcome back to the Rebuild Health and Fitness Podcast. And today we have back on the Muscle Nerds. How are we?
We are good.
Yeah, we're good.
It's the third episode.
Yeah.
Just going to keep them going now, just be a continuum.
Lucky. Yeah.
And we'll be like 50 years old and we'll still be welcoming you back. So some things we're going to talk about today is what do we have to give up if we need to be successful? And then the second half will be about changing your body composition. So when I'm talking about giving things up to be successful, that can be in dieting, business, life, can be quite goal dependent training. We'll start on dieting and then I'm sure it'll flow into a few different things. So I understand we want to make dieting as easy as possible, but there has to be some give or take. And what we see online, I believe at the moment, is this oversimplification in the marketing. Everything is really simple and just follow this simple process and then we'll set you to where you need to be. But I think that can be damaging because it can be really fairly unrealistic. And then when I have clients, I get that. And that's not as a backlash, but it's like, hey, things aren't happening. I'm like, yeah, this shit's hard.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things that we should be aware of when starting diet in terms of the way we feel, or some of the things that we have to, you know, get used to feeling? And then what are some of the things that we might actually have to give up?
It's a Luke question because I don't diet.
Well, man, there's so much to unpack on that.
Heaps.
Yeah, and especially now because as our industry always is, it's always separated into different segments and like little cliques. So you got like intuitive eating, you got people who say you got to track everything. Well, how do you track that? Do you need a weigh and measure? Do you use precision nutrition hand measurements? Some people say anti-dieting crowd goes, oh, you don't diet, diets don't work. Diets do work. You want to lose weight, you got to work on energy balance. And then, oh, it's not about calories. It's about food quality. It's about all of it. It's about all of it. And everyone's going to need a different strategy. So as a nutritionist, you have to talk to the client, say, look, I need to lay down, you know, how this process goes. So we need to talk about in a very easy manner, the biochemistry, how this stuff works and why you have to manage your energy. But then you have to look at it too. It's like, how fast do you want this to go? Because we can do it in a more healthy, sustainable manner, which is very small deficit. We chip away over time. Or we can do this. We can rip the Band-Aid off and go real fucking hard and do it really quick. But there's inherent complications between those two. The more stringent you get, the harder you get. If you don't have the mindset for it, you're going to set yourself up for failure because you may want to lose weight really fast, but mentally you may not be able to handle the style of dieting we have to do that. But you know, some people get neurotic about the numbers. So there's a lot of psychology that goes into it and you have to tailor everything to what the client can do. Like, I'm a big fan of tracking. I feel like when you look at the levels of competence, so you have like, you know, unconscious incompetence, you have unconscious competence, you have, and then you get to the level of conscious.
Unconscious competence.
Yeah. Unconscious competence. You have all these different levels and everyone's going to be at some point. And this is a terrible way of thinking about it, but it's the way I think about it, like training a dog. Like if you get your client's a puppy and if they have a massive level of unconscious incompetence, like they have no idea why they're fucking up because they have low nutritional literacy. Sometimes you got to put the choke collar on, you got to put a really short fucking leash on. So they may have to weigh and measure everything because they just simply don't understand how much energy is in the food they're eating. Like they think they're eating 1200 calories, but they're actually eating like 2000 because they're not measuring anything. So for a lot of clients that we do, we'll have them weigh and measure everything, at least initially, so that they understand, like, holy shit, like, fucking 50 grams of grapes, that has more energy than I thought, and it's a lot less food than I thought. So they have to get to a level where they can look at a piece of food and go, okay, is that 100 calories or is that 500 calories?
Just one real quick before I forget.
Here in Australia, you guys love your sauces, and that's where a lot of people fuck up there. Yeah. They add sauces and all this shit, and they're like, well, it's just a tiny container of sauce. Well, that tiny container of sauce is 250 calories.
I always tell a story. I've done it a few times. Back in the day, I used to eat 500 calories of mayonnaise a day.
I could easily do that. Like, I fucking love mayonnaise.
I used to have two big meals, like rice and tuna, and I would just like squirt. And then one day I was like, I'm going to measure this out. And I was like, it's like between 400 and 500 a day. I was like,
I could easily do that. And do you know what? Most people easily could do that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't think it was excessive. When people come in, they're like, oh, I only had 10 grams of tomato sauce. No, you didn't.
Well, that's the problem I have with the whole intuitive eating thing. Like, if you have low nutritional literacy, and you have issues with like hunger cues and hormones and food issues, mental, psychological issues.
Yeah.
You can't eat intuitively. Intuitive eating is what fucked you up in the first place.
Yeah.
But in regards to that, like the four levels of competence, intuitive eating sits at the top and you cannot get, which is unconscious competence. So you've got unconscious incompetence, which is you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
Then you go to conscious incompetence where it's like, I know I don't understand that. I know I don't know. So you're aware of something, but you don't have the knowledge around it. Then you go to conscious competence, which is I'm consciously learning how to do it. I have to think about it. So if you think about driving a car, it's like when you first start driving a car, you actually have to consciously think about it. And then when you go to unconscious competence, which is where the intuitive eating lies, that's when you're just doing things of second nature. The difficulty with that, though, is that's where errors start to come in. Like if you're driving a car, that's when you start texting when you're driving, putting on some makeup, and you need to bring yourself down into conscious competence every now and again just to like recheck yourself. And that's what, I mean, you've tracked everything you've eaten for the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, not lately, but like the thing is like, I'm a precision and accuracy guy. So if I'm like, okay, I'm going to lose 3 kilos and I'm going to drop a couple of percent body fat, I'm going to track everything because I like the precision. It's actually comforting for me to neurotically track that stuff. But then once I hit that goal, I'm like, okay, cool. I'm just going to free eat because I can manage my hunger. I know how much I'm eating instinctually, but only because I've been doing it my whole life. But a lot of people will need that structure. So, you know, most trainers, depending on where you live, like in Australia, if you're a trainer, you can't, without nutritional qualifications, you can't give them a meal plan. Even though everyone does anyways, because the clients expect that. But you're not supposed to. But sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes you have to say, look, I'm going to give you, if I didn't have nutrition qualifications, if I was just a PT, I'd say, let me give you a template of someone your body weight would probably do really well as. This is not your meal plan, wink, wink. But if you followed this, you would probably see some really good results and get them to the point where they have some structure. They have structure, they have they develop an eating pattern, they develop a habit, and they turn that habit into a ritual, so then they don't have to actually think about it. They know what they're doing every day, then we move into flexible dieting, say, okay, you don't have to have this at this meal, you can switch it out with, here's a list, and here's a weight of what you would use, feel free to switch those things out. But a lot of people need things to be really simplified, and what I like to do as a reductionist type of strategy where we try to slim it down to just the, what do you need to nail right now? And let's not overcomplicate this because people go, what about meal timing? When should I have my fucking amino acids? No. You just get good at breakfast, lunch, dinner, and maybe a shake.
Yeah.
Like, we're good. Don't get too caught up in, you're not a high performance athlete. You're not an Olympic athlete. You don't need to worry about meal timing. Just get the fucking food in. Eat some veggies, like more than one little broccoli, like eat your veggies and get your protein in.
Yeah.
You know, it's most of the people like at our gym, when we sit down and ask people what they eat right now, I'm like, okay.
Oh, they all just say they eat well.
I eat well.
Everyone does.
Everyone. Yeah.
But what the fuck does that mean? Right.
We had one guy who what we do at our gym is if someone's interested in talking about nutrition, we're like, okay, well we need you to like keep a food log for a couple of days. Like whether that's we use Chronometer instead of MyFitnessPal, but whether you put it into Chronometer or whether you write down everything you eat, but we just need to know where you're at because we won't overhaul someone's diet. Well, yeah, we won't overhaul someone's diet, but we'll just say, okay, you can make some changes here and here because it's the easiest thing. So then, because you can't expect someone to go to bed on like Sunday night and then Monday morning they wake up and they eat in this completely foreign way to them. Like that's just, they're never going to sustain that. But we had one guy who did it and he swapped out his, I think it was like his cereal for an omelet. And he goes, I thought I was doing the right thing, but there was like 400 calories more in my omelet meal. And I guess he was putting in like milk and cream and like six eggs and stuff like that. And he was like, I was so surprised because people associate like health and calories to be the same thing, but it's, it's not.
Yeah. What was I going to go? Part of it is just getting them to understand what's in the food. Like we had another guy who, he liked to have a little bit of wine on the weekends and he didn't realize he was drinking like 4,000 to 5,000 calories of wine over the weekend. So he started figuring out, well, what can I switch? What if I'm going to booze, is there a lower calorie booze that I can use? And maybe I need to, maybe I got a bit of a problem. I need to drop some of this out a little bit. And he did. And he lost a ton of weight.
Yeah. And just being accurate is the big one. I've got, hey, Amy, I'm going to talk about you. Got a weightlifter that's ready. She's got to make weights for states, I think, or a competition in a couple of weeks. She's like, right, we're 2 weeks out. I need to drop some weight. And I said, all right, for this first 7 days, we're not going to do anything. You're just going to be accurate. Nothing changes with your calorie goal. You're just going to be super, super accurate. And we're like 900 grams down in like 4 days.
Yeah.
That's amazing. just be accurate. And I think another thing I wanted to touch on was just, I think when people are going into a diet, they don't understand that they are going to be hungry. They have no idea. Because every time they're hungry, they just eat. So they're coming in, you know, the amount of message, one that I get constantly is like, they're like 2 days in, they're like, I'm starving. I'm like, you're not, you're peckish. Like, get used right. to it. The problem we're here is in the first place that every time you have any remote hunger, you fucking, you feed.
Yeah. A lot of times people are just bored. They're just bored. They're used to eating in a certain pattern. And now they haven't eaten for 4 hours. They haven't snacked on anything. Like, oh, I'm so hungry. Like, you're not. Get a hobby, do something, drink some more water because nobody here drinks enough water.
Yeah.
You know, there's other ways to create fill with high volume foods that have lower calories. Like nobody eats enough veggies, eat more veggies, you know, but the hunger thing, it's really going to depend on the situation. If you're really overweight and you have a lot of stored energy, you have plenty of food you've already eaten that you couldn't process before. You're not going to starve to death if you go on a lower calorie diet. Trust me. Now, what you may need is to add a good multivitamin, maybe some fish oil so you can get some, or eat fish so you can get some essential fatty acids. But no one that needs to lose 25, 30 kilos is going to starve to death after 2 months of dieting, but they do need the nutrition. You don't want to be in a nutritional deficit because you need those cofactors to run your biochemistry. But that the other thing is that the hunger hormones like leptin. The more overweight you get, the more leptin you're going to have, and that provides or promotes leptin resistance. So you don't ever feel like you're satiated because if leptin is in high amounts, and so you think about leptin as kind of the key, and the lock is the leptin receptor. If you have leptin resistance and insulin resistance, you're always going to feel hungry. You're never going to feel satisfied. Yeah. And this is when you go to an American buffet and you see the really big people and they're eating like 13, 14 plates of food. And they're like, I'm still hungry. They didn't even touch the side. I'm like, dude, you don't, you're hungry, but you don't need it.
Yeah.
But there's like the psychological hunger and then the physiological hunger. So it's like what I think a thing you've mentioned in the past is sometimes you like using like a
fasting
for like a day or two to teach them what a true hunger cue is. So it's not just like that boredom hunger cue or that habitual hunger cue. Or it's like, oh, I'm used to eating this time and now I'm hungry. It's like,
you're right. Let's pull food out until you feel the migrating motor complex. When your stomach goes, cool. You can eat.
Yeah, right. there's a couple of things here. I remember Martin McDonald, the guy I did nutrition with. He said this, if he had someone like really, really obese, he would give it a 24, 48 hour fast. Yeah. Just so they go, hey, every time you're hungry, you don't have to, don't have to eat. And then there was that research, what was it? That Mr. AB, that 208 kilo guy who didn't eat for like 382 days. And then he was like 82 kilos.
Yeah.
Because he had all this excess weight. He obviously had doctors and vitamins and minerals and stuff pumped into him. But it's like, he was fine.
Yeah, vitamins, minerals, water. That's all he had for over a year.
Yeah.
And he kept it off too.
I think he gained like 6 kilos back or something.
Yeah. It's amazing. I the thing is like, and you get, again, the industry, crazy people in the industry, and they think fasting's the best thing ever. Yeah, yeah. I like fasting. not all the time. It depends on the person. If you're gen pop person, you're not training a lot. Cool. Fast, man. If you're not training a lot, you can go on a huge deficit and then add back the cofactors. The more you train, the more you're going to have to eat. So a lot of it's, you know, trying to match energy balance somewhere and having just enough of a deficit to pull as the whatever weight we want to come off, but not enough to affect you in a negative manner as far as physiological and performance.
I mean, every diet method is just a tool to be used with the right person at the right time for the right reason. And it's like you should be open to utilizing anything. It's just whatever's going to work for their client. And I think people just get really lost in the weeds. Mm. It's so simple. But simple doesn't mean easy. I know that. Yeah. But
it's also easy to be confused because you have people that call people, you know, keto retards and fasting retards.
Ketards.
And and it's confusing to the general population. It's like keto may be the thing that works for you. That's nothing wrong with that. Or you can be a carnivore. That's fine too. It depends on what you can feel satiated and happy on while still maintaining some type of long-term deficit.
Yeah, I think it's important to try. I think you figure out pretty quick if it's for you or if
a lot of people, like I'm sure you guys find this as well, like a lot of clients we get have tried
everything.
And they're like, oh, what one worked for you? Like all of them. Yeah. Now I'm back where I started.
What do you know what though? That whole thing is like I remember we had a client come to us years ago and he was like, the only thing that ever worked was when I was training twice a day and I was on like however many calories he was on. And I remember you saying to him, it's like, well, if it worked, you wouldn't be back here where you are.
Yeah.
Like you, what works is something that you can maintain like for the rest of your life. That's what's going to work.
You lose a heap of weight, put it back on, it didn't work.
Yeah.
You need to find what's going to work. A lot of people have done everything, just not long enough for it to be effective, you know. But
yeah,
it's a hard sell at the beginning though, isn't it, when you're like, right.
It's an overwhelming sell.
For like the next 2 years.
And just and people just think like, I have to eat like this for the rest of my life. Like, no, thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's what I try and get across with dieting as well. Just remember right now, this is going to be the lowest amount of calories you'll ever be on.
Yeah.
And then we can pump this up probably way more than what you ever believed that you could if you give us enough time to do it.
Yeah.
But they don't want to do that, especially when they get to the place where they've hit the result and then they're just like,
all right, back to where I was before.
Yeah. Or I'm free. I'll tend to put caps on people's weight. No idea, but like, hey, 90 kilos. Once we're at, you know, 88, then we never want to see 90. If we see 90 again, it's like,
we're dieting.
We need
again.
To stop.
Yeah,
fucking doing some stuff, but they don't. They just go, shit.
Yeah.
James, I fucked up.
That's a good strategy. You should have a wiggle room range and say, okay, if you're, say, 115, we're going to try to get to 100. So we're going to try to stay between 97 and 100. You go over 100, we're going to diet down. Maybe we need to diet down to 95 and keep it between 95 and 98. And you can kind of roam around between those ranges and keep them on track. But that also dictates that they need to weigh themselves a lot, which people in the industry going, you shouldn't weigh yourself, blah, blah. It depends on the client and their viewpoint on what the scale means and what it doesn't mean.
Mm.
If you find that your weight has some type of inherent, that's how you view your self-worth, Earth's gravitational pull, okay, the scale's probably not going to be a great metric, but you can train somebody over time to view that number as something different.
Mm.
But, you know, commercialism tells you one thing, you're too big, you're not small enough, whatever. It's just one metric out of multiple metrics that we'll use with, maybe we use circumference measurements, with photos, with maybe an in-body scan or a DEXA scan, with the scale. And you need all these different compartments that you're measuring. And if one of those is screwing your head up, well, we'll get rid of that. We'll work on something else like circumference measures, because those are easy. Clients can do them themselves once they're trained how to do them. And then that way, if the scale goes up, but the circumferences go down, especially in the waist, you just built some muscle and lost some fat. Fantastic.
A lot of the complication around diet comes from the fact that every single person has some type of psychological or emotion tied to food, whether that's like enjoyment, pleasure, guilt, it's socializing. It's, you know, like it's to try and take such an emotive topic and make it so black and white and non-emotive is just, it's like almost impossible. So you really have to work with the person that's in front of you and you find that thing that works for them that doesn't just mess them up.
And this is, it's like we always say, a good relationship with food is being able to say yes and no to it. So he's trying to give everyone like some sort of food freedom maybe at the beginning, like, you know, never feel guilty when you eat food, but then they go totally the other way.
Yeah.
Like, I love everything. I'm like, well, no, you should be able to say no as well.
Yeah.
And that should be fine. But now that's, looked upon as like
and you don't
restrictive.
Want,
yeah. It's like it's not.
You also don't want to instill fear around food into your wine either. So it's a really fine line. Like it's a really delicate dance. But I remember, I can't remember who it was. It was one of the figures in the industry, like the guy who used to train Gary Vee. Syed?
Oh, Jordan Syed.
One thing he put out I really liked, he says, progress for one person might be not eating the cake. Progress for another person might be eating the cake and not feeling guilty about it. Like, so it's so vastly different for everyone. And I really liked that actually. And I was like, that's like nail on the head.
Yeah, it's very true. Because we got like, you know, I've got a client now who is feeling really guilty about wanting to diet in an office environment where there's food everywhere. They're always bringing out sweets and let's go out for lunch and all that kind of stuff. And she's like trying to be the one who says no. And then the other people there
you
almost
no
like
support.
Diet shame. Yep. Like, oh, you know, just have it. You can have it.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I used to eat it all the time. I used to work in an office environment that was like a feeding environment. Yeah. Like we had like a whole breakfast bar that was for free, always lunches, always morning teas, people bringing in cupcakes. Yeah, and anytime you turn them down, I always used to get, well, you might get hit by a bus the next day. Like what are you being, this is ridiculous. And I was like, yeah, but I think if I get hit by a bus, my last thought's not going to be like, I wish I'd eaten that cupcake. Yeah.
If I keep eating these cupcakes and gain 30 kilos, I'm more likely to get hit by that bus because I can't get out of the way.
Move, but a lot of people bring in cupcakes or cakes to offices because they don't want to feel alone in what they're doing, so they share it with other people and believe it's okay.
But the diet shame is real. Like I spent 1 year in an office and it was the one of the worst years of my life, and I had just come off of a contest, a physique show, so I was like 7.5% body fat. I walk in, everybody's like, ooh, the fitness dudes, so they're all asking. Yeah. The first, here is a not, it's the novelty. The first few weeks, everyone wants advice, and stupid me, I'm like, okay, I'll help you. By about the third month, I'd be sitting at my desk, typing on my computer. I'd turn to ask somebody a question. They'd be deep throating a slice of pizza. They'd stop and look at me and go, don't judge me. I'm like, I don't give a shit. Yeah. I don't care that you eat the pizza.
Yeah.
Jesus.
This is really interesting because I had this conversation this week about, so say there's some clients and they're in a certain place, right? And we very rarely actually talk about the food that they've eaten, but yet they constantly, I don't know if it, what it's from, they constantly are worried that I'm going to judge them on the food that they've had, even though they have no evidence that that is ever going to be.
Yeah, people come to it. There's a lot of preconceived notions about like what trainers and nutritionists and stuff are like, right? And that's one of them, is that it's they're just like shame. I mean, I think that would be, I don't know if that would be a social media thing.
I mean, that's,
but it must have been shaped by like some like experience they've had in the past, because there's some trainers who are like that when they're when they're going into that sort of challenge mentality. Like, what the fuck? You're meant to stick to this.
Well, it's that whole boot camp mentality, right?
Yeah,
like that drill sergeant type. One, I get, I don't know.
Some coaches are just dicks.
So
I go the opposite way. If my clients go, man, I'm really sorry I missed these sessions and I ate a little bit too much, that's why you don't see anything logged on Saturday, I just tell them straight up, I don't give a shit if you do this or not. That's my job, is to tell you what to do, tell you how to get there. It's not my job to slap a donut out of your hand. So you just, that's fine. You just delayed the process, but it doesn't affect me either way.
Yeah.
If I want you to get your results, that's what you're paying me for, but I'm doing my job. If you're not going to do your side of it, then that's on you. I don't care. Like, don't think I'm going to shame you. I would actually rather you do your best to try to track the binges, which sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Mm. But if you track the binge, I can try to figure out a solution. But if you don't track the binge, I have no idea what to do.
That's a really good point, right? Because everyone likes tracking when they're eating wonderfully. Then they don't track when it's just like, if you just did it the opposite way around, life would be a lot easier.
They'll just bury their head in the sand because they'll just think like ignoring it means that the effects won't be as.
They'll say, I didn't know how to track this because it's not chronometer. Just do your best. Like tracking something and having some, it's like close to accuracy is better than tracking nothing, having zero accuracy.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I would say like, I'd rather see 10,000 calories in there a day than no calories in there.
Yeah.
Because at least I know.
Yeah. Like Luke says, you can come up with a strategy then, because there's a strategy you do for like people who binge. You just jack their calories right up.
Yeah, I jack their calories up until they stop binging. And then they're always like, well, I can't eat 3,000 calories. I'm supposed to be eating 1,200. I'm like, you're already eating that. You might as well fill it up with good food, get rid of the binging and the
consciously
guilt.
Consciously eat it,
And almost every time they end up losing weight on double or almost triple the calories, because at least now they're eating good food, positive stimulation food, instead of eating a bunch of shit and feeling guilty about it.
Yeah, that's right. I think getting people to eat up, you're all right. Like, you need to eat these calories. So say, give someone 2,400 and they're eating to 18. I'm like, no, get to 24.
Yeah.
I don't care what you've got to fill it with. Get to 24. Like, I just not get to 24.
Yep.
Yeah. Guess what? Yeah, they tend to stop overeating, right? Or reaching for the foods that they usually reach for because they're just thin.
But you get crazy shit too, where you know everybody's anti-processed foods. Like, look, if you can have some processed food, you're going to be fine. It's not going to kill you. Like, I need you to get this in. I had one guy a couple of weeks ago. I told him to eat white rice. He goes, "Oh, I don't eat white rice because it's processed." Yeah, right. Fucking serious?
Yeah, right.
Eat gross ass brown rice if you want.
I mean
the
that's so good. It's
fucking true.
Like the whole process of eating is processing your food. Yeah. If you're eating beef mince, it's already been processed. If you're chewing and masticating your food, you're processing it. Yeah. So, you know, obviously we want to try to get people to eat as much unprocessed foods and natural and whole foods as possible, because we do know that's more nutritious, but you can have some of this other stuff as well, especially if you need to fill in your calories. Because I was trying to get him to have protein powder to get his protein up, and he goes, "Oh, I don't want to do that. It's processed. What else can I eat?" I'm like, "Well, just eat more meat.
Just go and kill a deer and just gnaw on it.
Put your fucking loincloth on and go out in the country and murder your animal and do it that way if you want it." So totally paleo.
But there's,
go on.
I was just going to say, there's always a really fine line between it going out of our pay grade with dealing, like when I was talking about, there's just so much psychological attachment to food, and it's so different for everybody that there is a point where you're like, 100%. Either probably shouldn't diet, or you need to go and talk to someone about like.
Yeah, I think that's a fine conversation to have, and they usually respect you for it. I think
there's not many people act on it though.
Yeah. You can't help everyone.
No.
Open my drawer.
Which
top one? Don't open that one. That's my dildos are in that one. Is there a lolly? So I'll always put, like, I always say when I've got nutrition stuff, I'm like, you know, I always look high food, low energy, high nutrient or whatever it is. And everything's just on a scale. I'm like, everything's fine. And I always say, if I've got an apple or I've got some Allen's lollies, I'm going to go and train. What am I going to eat? And everyone's like, the apple. And I was like, fuck no, I don't want a fucking apple. I'm about to go and train. Give me some, you know what I mean? Give me some lolly. So everything has its place. Just have that understanding.
Well, I had a client years ago. She was dealing with a bunch of injuries, and she played Gaelic football and also AFL at a high level, plus her training, plus she commuted on her bike to work and back. Mm-hmm. She was dealing, she had gone to a different trainer training company, and they had her on like 1500 calories, and she was probably training 24 hours a week between all of that stuff. And she had all these injuries, and she had seen five or six other therapists to figure out what's going on. They all told her that it was the same problem. They all gave her the same rehab exercise. It wasn't working. Mm. So she flew up from Melbourne to see me, and I went, look, I'm just going to tell you, like, all these people, I mean, you've seen Andrew Locke, like, you've seen all these other people, they're all right. Like, I'm going to tell you the same thing they did. Mm. So let's figure out if it's something different. And I found out she needed like 3,400 calories. She was eating like 1,500. And then she would go on these massive sugar binges where she's almost snorting sugar, you know? And so that was one of the people that I said, look, we're going to pump your calories up to like 3,400. Let's pump it up close to maintenance. She was terrified. Yeah. Like, look, the reason you're not healing is because you don't have enough energy on board. So let's get the energy on board. She did. She lost something like some ridiculous amount, like 3 kilos in a week, just adding more food, and all of her injuries went away, and she started smashing it in her competitions. But this is how fucked her mentality was, because it's how she was programmed, training with these other people for 4 years. She showed up for a game and didn't have any carbohydrates or any. I said, you need to take some carbs with you before you play. She goes, I couldn't get any. I don't know what to do. I go, what do you have around you? I've got, there's a servo. I'm like, go in there, buy a bag of Skittles. Do you like Skittles? Yeah. Eats a family pack of Skittles. Fucking crushes the game. Crushes the game. They name her captain of the team. And then the next Sunday when she goes to play, she goes, what do I do for carbs? I go, well, Skittles worked really well last week, so why don't we just eat more Skittles? She goes, well, what about red dye number 40?
What about what?
Yeah, oh, right. I'm like, what? She goes, well, they told me at the other place. I'm like, just eat the fucking Skittles, man.
Yeah, seriously. That's
but
crazy.
There's a difference between like sports nutrition too and just like nutrition for fat loss as well. Like that's kind of where it becomes a lot more nuanced. And you got sports nutrition.
And difference between physique.
Yeah.
You know, most people are getting information from bodybuilders. And if you're training, like that may or may not work for gym pop. And it definitely, bodybuilding nutrition should never be used with a performance athlete.
Mm.
Unless you want them to not perform well.
So talking about that. So The next thing I sort of want to talk about is sort of like body recomposition in a way, but more like changing your body composition. Because if I say body recomposition, a lot of people think losing fat and building muscle at the same time, and usually fall into three groups here. It's like, yes, we can do it. No, we can't do it. Or two, we can do both, but not directly, you know, at the same time.
No, you absolutely can do both at the same time. It's not as efficient. If you have, let's say you have a lot of weight to lose, doing a slow recomp like that, it's not the most efficient way of doing it. So if I had somebody that came in, and people are always way fatter than they think. Like, I have a guy I've trained on and off for years. He was 207 pounds. And he's like, I go, what are we going to do? He came back on for training. He's like, I want 10%. I want to have a six pack. I'm like, okay, you're going to have to lose like 50 pounds. 40 pounds probably. He's like, no. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, you are. So I put him on a protein sparing modified fast, very low calories, right? Adjusted his training for it. He lost 13 kilos in 12 weeks. Was 12? No, it was faster than that. And he's like, I'm still fat. I'm like, I told you, you probably have another 12 kilos to go. And so now he's now knuckled down. We've now that we've got that big, we've got half of it off. Now we've moved to a slower recomp, so we pumped the calories up. So now we're just focusing on losing 300 or 400, maybe 500 grams a week. Like, okay, let's take another 24 weeks to get there, and we'll go with a recomp. That way you build muscle and grow into that. But it really just depends on what the priority is. If fat loss is a priority, you probably want to not just try to hold on as much muscle tissue as you can. Keep your protein high, because that's going to be the biggest factor, and don't train too much. Because people will start utilizing exercise to burn calories. When you don't have a lot of calories on board, that's a disaster.
So where would you put that protein at this point?
As high as they can get it. I always say, what can you afford? What can you digest? And what do you want? So if you're somebody, if you're Texan and you look protein, I'm going to pump it up. I usually cap it off around like three grams per kilo, maybe 3.3.
Yeah, wow.
It's not to me. I used to eat like 4.4. I just can't afford it with the fucking meat prices right now. Yeah. But
a lot of smelly farts going on.
Always. It's always something. If it's not the protein,
doesn't matter what I eat, that happens.
Yeah.
But I'll put people on around two. Probably the most often protein amount is about 2.5 grams per kilo. So we try to keep between that 2.2 to 2.5. But I'm also a big believer in like protein leverage diets. So if you need to lose a lot of fat, I still much prefer a low carb diet, but I've stopped calling it a low carb. I call it a lower carb diet. Mm-hmm. So I tend to start off by lowering the carbohydrates quite a bit and keeping the fat and the protein high, because that unlocks a lot more protein choices. It makes your food taste better. People tend to digest things a bit slower, so they tend to be happier on that type of diet. But when I say low carb, I'm talking about the traditional low carb. Traditionally in the research, low carb was anything under 40%. Nowadays it's like negative carbs.
Just zero.
Celery.
You can't even look at carbs anymore. It's like, no, that's that. If we're, you know, you something around like 130 grams of carbs instead of, you don't have to go to keto land for this, and you can still be really, you can be really happy and satiated. You can still have some rice, some potatoes and things like that. But then again, it depends on what type of person they are. If they really love carbs, okay, let's take the fat down a little bit. The only non-negotiable for me is I want your protein to be at least 2 to 2.2 grams per kilo.
Yeah. And that's where I suppose it can get a little bit difficult. I suppose if you're talking general pop as well, cause you just look at people have these massive protein intakes, but their calories are put on so low, and the math doesn't always make sense, or they just really struggle at that point as well. I'll sort of look at a recomp usually with people that are, quite skinny or skinny fat. Yeah, it's that skinny fat, right? And they come in and they just like, I'm just not lean enough yet. I just need to keep going. I'm like, you need to stop for now, right? We need to spend a little bit of time building, or you're never going to sort of find.
Yeah, you're like, man, you got really shredded bones.
Yeah.
You look like a fucking coat hanger.
Yeah.
Like, how lean what are you getting? Like, what's the machinist? Is that what you're trying to look like?
Full Christian Bale.
Yeah, like that's not really a great look. So building the muscle. But a lot of that has to do with doing the right types of training, the programming, doing more hypertrophy-based stuff, and keeping your protein high.
Yeah. I've got that to come. Big one to come about that. So when would you go a certain way? So would you look at a certain body fat percentage in terms of, hey, let's diet, or hey, let's
yeah,
build? Or is it like physiological and psychological too, right?
Yeah, there's really no good numbers. You can make some assumptions. I usually will say, look, I like guys to try to get somewhere about 15 to 16%, maybe 17% is my upper threshold. So if I can get you down below 15 and then kind of keep you between 15 and 17, and then once you start hitting close to 18, 19, let's pull it back down. For women, we usually add about 5 or 6% on top of that. Mm. But so for women, we look at, you know, somewhere around maybe 24 to 27. Mm. And then if they want to stay lean, then we might take them down a little bit closer to 21, 22 and kind of stay in that area. But I'm also talking about true body fat percentage, not people's weird idea what true body fat percentage is, because like 15% is leaner than you think it is.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys who think they're 15%, they're like 28%. A lot of girls who think they're 16%, they're more like 32%.
Because their scale told them what percentage.
That's it.
Home scales. Yeah. You're a big fan. Well, you historically have been a big fan of getting them leaner first and then going on muscle. Because isn't it easier to put on muscle if you're not as...
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of arguments about that. About like, what's it, P ratio. Yeah. And I just, from experience... What I see is the fatter you get, the more insulin resistant you get, the harder it is to put on muscle and the easier it is to put on fat. And if you think about, if you think about what happens when we age, people naturally get more insulin resistant. They also have to eat more protein because they don't have an anabolic response. They become anabolically resistant. For me, a lot of the times when I see people like guys getting close to 20%, they're bulking, but they're not putting on the type of bulk they're looking for. And I'm convinced that there's an anabolic resistance issue because the insulin receptor is not working that well. Mm. People argue about this, but you know, I don't think the data is conclusive. You see people talk about, well, look at sumo wrestlers. They're really fat and they have lots of muscle. I'm like, yeah, but
I mean, they're the people that we want to be looking for advice now.
Well, and it's like, and they'll say like, well, what about American NFL linemen? I'm like, okay, you can't take the top 0.001% of natural freaks and you know, Russian creatine supported freaks. You can't look at them and then look at a Gen Pop person and go, that's the same. Because growing up in Texas, I had to play against some of these guys who went to play pro ball, and they were like man children at like 14. You get guys that are like 280 pounds and 6'5", and they're 14, and they've had a beard for like since they were eight. You can't look at that and make assumptions on whether this stuff is real or not. You have to look at normal people.
Yeah. Plus, they're going to be motivated easier, right? If you get someone a little bit leaner to start, and every like 1 pound of muscle mass they build, they're going to just see it.
They'll
a little
see
bit more,
it,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to look at that too. Yeah, so if you are trying to build muscle and you're already a little bit rotund, you're not going to look better. You're going to be getting bigger and stronger, but you're going to be looking worse. Mm. You're probably better off getting to, you know, a certain amount of leanness, at least like 15%. I think that's reasonable. That's not that hard to get to. And then try to put on, and when you start to look a little sloppy, that's easy to clean up in a few weeks. Mm. But you'll get guys that, you know, you look really good in clothes and you take your shirt off, you look like a fucking melted candle. Like you have to look at it like that. But then you go the other way. Yeah. I was talking to one of my clients about this. He's jacked as fuck. And he's like, I'm so skinny. I'm 95 kilos. He's got full on abs, giant legs. He's like, I'm like, yeah, but you only look skinny in clothes. He goes, but I'm training out at Pro Raw and there's all these monsters. I'm like, yeah, but you also, they're also like, waiting for it to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
And they're all fucked up and they're all joint issues and all this stuff. And part of the reason why we took him down from like 105, we took him down from 105 to like 87. And then I built him back up to 95 because he was having a bunch of joint issues. Mm. Like, well, we're going to fix this a lot easier if we get you tidy your physique up a little bit and work on fixing these things. And then we can start going back the other way, but not to the point where you get overly fat.
Was that pro or was that powerlifting?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, you've spoken about like ideal body fat percentages a few times, which will sort of dictate your decision about your approach to things. What's your preferred method of working that out? Do you like recommend DEXA scans or just like weigh, yeah, measure? Like?
That's I like to go to multiple different components. Because I've been in the physique side of things pretty much my whole life, I like to use pictures, number one. I like to use circumference measures. I like the Navy body fat test because it's all you need is a $10 tape, and you can get a really good assessment on that. So you can look at that and say, well.
Also, I've never even heard of that.
So the American military, a lot of the different branches that were trying to figure out how to work out body composition in something that was easy to do and didn't take a lot of technical skill or cost. So they did a bunch of research on circumference measures and versus your height and your weight, yeah, and all, yeah, that. And then they weighted against hydrostatic dunking, right? And they found it's pretty damn accurate if you do it correctly. It's got about as inaccurate as a DEXA scan, which is 3 to 5% up and down. Mm. So if you get that, and maybe you do a DEXA scan, maybe you do skin folds, in body, whatever you use, and then you just keep using that same method. Thing. Look at the pictures and say, okay, what is my percentage? How do I look at that percentage? Okay, that gives me a good reference point. When I start looking really good, what does that method show me at now? Because there's no body fat method that's really good. They're all prone to error. Mm. And different body types will hold things differently. So even if you look at something like a DEXA or you look at an InBody, your fat cells aren't just fat. There's fat-free mass in the fat cells too. Mm. So you could have people with big, larger fat cells, but they test leaner than they actually really are, because you're measuring fat-free mass inside of the fat cell. If you have somebody with a smaller fat cell, it might be more fat in the fat cell and less fat-free mass. They may actually click off fatter, even though they look really lean. So that's what's really hard.
That's also different prices for DEXA scans, right? Not every single one of them is the gold standard, right?
Yeah.
And DEXAs are all different. So when COVID first hit, and I stopped traveling, I was like, okay, we live out where, you know, you get Uber Eats. There's a few really nice places, but most of them aren't that great. And you can only have so much Uber Eats of the same restaurant. So we're like, screw it. I'm just going to pull out the air fryer and I'm going to get lean again. And I got ridiculously lean. So I went and did a DEXA scan. I was 6.75% on the DEXA. I was probably more like 9.5 to 10. Navy body fat had me at like 9, something like that. Skin folds had me at like 11. So they're all quite a bit different. Earlier this year, I got even leaner. I went to a different DEXA scan. It had me at 8.8. So even DEXA scans aren't the same between them. Some models are better and some of the programming is better than others. But I would say that DEXA scan that I did in Red Cliff was actually more accurate than the place I went to in Brisbane that's all they do are scans. Mm. Like the margin for error was much smaller with the medical place I went to in Redcliffe.
So if you go on to, like, let's talk about building muscle a little bit.
But at the end of the day, the body fat percentage doesn't really matter. What matters is do you like the way you look and feel, right? Because my buddy Nick Daniel said it best to me one time. He goes, you're only as lean as your fattest spot. I'm like, okay, there you go.
God damn it.
It's my back, but I can't see my back.
So it doesn't matter. Nah. Out of sight, out of mind.
That's it.
Mine's my duke.
It's your fittest.
actually, because I used to, when I was teaching, I started talking about getting people dick skin lean, and that kind of became a thing with our students. And one day I just decided, I wonder what dick skin lean is. So I measured it. It's 2.8 millimeters.
What, thick skin?
Yeah.
Dick skin is, yeah. Yeah.
I've never measured it.
So
I used to know it on a Foxtel remote. sorry.
That's kind of my metric. Can you cover your cell phone? If you do, you're doing all right.
I don't know. These iPhone Max Pros now.
The
big one.
The iPhone 3.
You can ask somebody with those Nokia flip phones. They're not going to flip it out. They're going to go, I'm good. No,
that's it. I'll be keeping it there. All right. So building muscle, there's, let's just say I've had an example. So I was working with this girl for a while, training super well, starting to sort of just lose some tiredness, some energy, some things like that. She's in good shape. I'm just like,
let's just stop for a little while. All you need to focus on is getting fitter, faster, stronger. We can measure their metrics. And I say, if you keep getting fitter, faster, and stronger, your body composition will then do what it needs to do, right? So we're sort of performing these metrics. One thing with her is that she's still quite young in sort of her development to how long she's been training. And I think some people underestimate training age being a natural thing. How important is training age?
In what way?
I think it's often overlooked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In terms of, I'm not in the shape I want to be yet. But I was like, but you're still so early on into your training. And they might be comparing themselves naturally to maybe somebody else that's been training a long time.
Yeah, there's something to be said about like muscle maturity. And there's a lot of things that are happening with cell differentiation and becoming more myonucleated. So when you're training and you're breaking that muscle tissue and you're creating that adaptive response, you get things, the muscle changes in a very specific manner. So depending on how you train, right? So you start breaking things down and the muscle fibers get thicker, you grow more nucleus to control all that, and you get things like muscle memory, right? Mm. So people that have been training for years will have physiques that look radically different than people who have been training for not very long. It also depends on how you train. So if you're doing a lot of pump up stuff, you look at like traditional bodybuilders where you're just pumping everything up, you're not really going to failure. They're going to usually have a different look than somebody who's, say, a powerlifter or a strongman who's going full tilt, heavy reps, and creating a lot more muscle damage. So typically they'll have a bit different look. Mm. Because in one instance of bodybuilders, you've got this concept of easy come, easy go. As long as you're pumping the muscle up and causing an inflammatory response, you're going to draw fluid to that, and the muscle cells are going to expand, but they're not necessarily going to get as thick as when you're hitting heavy weights. And then you've got a neurological component too with the sympathetic system. The more sympathetically driven stuff you do, the harder you're going to look. So the muscle quality looks different. So people will get in that trap because of things like Instagram, and they think, oh, if I just train for 12 weeks, I'm going to look like this guy, this WBFF pro.
Well, no, that's how they market it though, right?
That is. But that WBFF pro has been training for 4 or 5 years and is really neurotic about it and hasn't had a single drink in that time and has tracked every piece of food, and he's on steroids and on recreational drugs and everything else that comes along with that side. But you can't compare yourself where somebody else is. And then that training age can change too. For me, training age is dependent on not just how long you've been training, but have you been training with under supervision on a qualified coach? Have you you followed your program very diligently? You've put in like thousands and thousands of hours of training. For me, there's also some strength metrics as well. And different body parts could be, you could go from beginner. We separate things out from beginner, novice, intermediate, advanced, elite. So for me, beginner is like those first 6 months. You have no idea what the fuck you're doing. Like, you've read about lifting, but your technique is shit. You don't move well. You don't have good muscle maturity. We need to work on a lot of foundational stuff. Then you become a novice, and then we keep working on that. And at 18 to 24 months, you become intermediate, and now we unlock more exercises, and you're actually creating above average strength. And then advanced, you're talking like 3 to 5 years, and elite, you're talking like 7 to 9 years.
Yeah, and like you said, that's proper training.
That's proper training with a dedicated purpose, not going to the gym and exercising, but training. And the difference is, anybody can exercise. Training is, you're training for a specific goal, and you've got a specific set of instructions in order to reach that goal, and you're actually doing it. But then you can also regress back to a beginner. Like right now, I would say, because of my lower back issues that I've had the last few years, if I look at strength standards, so you can go online and there's a really good website for that. If you type in strength standards, and you can see kind of where you are. Like right now, I'm at between advanced to elite with my bench press, but my squat's still at like novice intermediate.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You know, because I'm that training age, you have to look at it from a perspective of, have you been able to maintain that? If you get injured and your squat drops down, well, you probably need to train more like a novice in the back squat, and then earn the right to train like an intermediate or advanced later.
But suppose if your back mends, then you'd be able to get to advanced a lot quicker.
Much faster. Before, right? Yeah, much faster, because a lot of these structural changes don't really go away. They become dormant And that's why you get some people who can touch weights after not touching weights for a couple of years, and they just blow up really fast. So like when I did my first jiu-jitsu competition, I wanted to drop from 115 to 92. So I didn't touch weights for like 9 months. I think I did maybe two or three sessions in that time. I just did jiu-jitsu and a lot of conditioning, and I dropped down to 92.7. I realized I wasn't going to make the weight class with my gi, so I ate back up to 97. And then after that, I started training again. I put on like 7 kilos in 2 weeks just by lifting weights again. My bench went from when I stopped training, it was 125 kilos. When I did my comp, it was 120. I barely lost any. I lost a lot of lower body strength, but with all the tension you get in grappling, you won't lose that much upper.
Yeah.
But within 2 months of training again, my bench was back up to like 155.
Yeah. We had a girl, Lily Riley, on. She had kidney cancer. She's like an elite powerlifter. She just broke the Australian record.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think her doctor said, you can't train for ages. And she was like, obviously, like, fuck you, I'm going to train. But she put on like 20 kilos of muscle mass in like a very, very short period of time. Yeah. She never would have been able to do that, right? Unless she had been training very hard before.
Like, I feel like people really underestimate the work and time it would take. Like, I think Hedy Boydell said it once, and she goes, you cannot compare. You cannot use me as a comparison. She's like, I've done more training than anything else I've ever done in my life since she was like 4. And she's like, you'll never catch me. Like, you cannot. Like, you, and she's right. Like, if someone starts at 19 and she's been training since she was 4, and not only that, like just the work, like that dedication and the, not just the consistency, but also the intensity with
just turning up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That mindset, like most people won't get. And they look at, and like you mentioned with Instagram and the nutrition and social media, making it look easy. A lot of the WBFF pros or a lot of the people, they make it look like it's this fun, enjoyable, easy process without really like understanding. So people are like, yeah, I want to look like that, and think they can buy their program and do an 8-week challenge and then they'll look like that. But it's like, it's not going to happen.
And I don't want to sound bad to some people, but I look at them and they're on stage and they're supposed to be looking at their best, and I'm like, you look really bad. Yeah. You look poor. Happens. You look poor. Like there's no mass.
Yeah.
You've just tried to go down to a body fat. Yeah. It's as low as you could, but you have no mass. So you have no shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. That when they brought up bikini, that was a big deal. Like girls would go, they'd go with a girlfriend or watch your girlfriend compete, and they go, oh, that looks like fun. I'm gonna do that in 12 weeks. I'm like, you've never actually trained. They do a shit ton of cardio, they get on stage, they look terrible. They go, I don't know what happened. Well, you went to a coach who just wanted your money and wouldn't tell you the truth. And I used to turn girls away. I'd be like, look, this is you've got at least 9-month ordeal here just to get you ready to begin prepping for a show. And they'd say, well, this guy down the street said he could put me on stage in 3 months. I go, I could put you on stage. There is no, all you have to do is pay.
Yeah.
Anybody can get on stage.
Yeah.
Right? But do you want to get on stage to win, or do you want to get on stage and embarrass yourself?
Have you seen that meme? Have you seen that guy? It's like rip guy, and then like this little white guy. Have you seen that?
Hamish. But didn't he do it as well? Like, I know the one you were talking about. Right. It's not Hamish, but I'm pretty sure Hamish did it as well.
But Hamish Blake went to, did he?
Yeah. No tan.
New York bodybuilding contest.
Yeah.
And because of like just he ended up being the only one in the heavyweight division and he won.
Yeah. He did it. But I know the one you're talking about.
That's so what people funny. Do too. They'll go and they'll get on stage with, and they'll have like 3 people in their class. They'll go to some real shitty show and they'll just be the least shitty looking person and they'll win. They'll go, oh, now I'm a physique coach. Like, what? You don't know what you're doing. You look terrible.
That's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah.
I've got this one woman now, she's 50, and she at one point was on 600, 700 calories. That's what she's on for like long periods of time.
Yeah, we had that. Remember that one? There was a girl who a chick who had done like, she wasn't even for a physique show. She'd done a 12-week transformation and she was given a meal plan. And she was told the meal plan was what, like 1,200 calories?
15? Yeah. 15?
And, but Luke went through and actually, it was what, 800 or 900?
800 or 900.
And she got to the point, I think she was like 8 weeks in or something, and she's like, I'm not feeling good. She had all this stuff going on, and her coach was like, like, just, you've only got 4 weeks left.
Just
like,
try harder.
You're going to get the best transformation that we've ever had. Like, just keep going. And she ended up having to like send her kid back to the country Malaysia that she was born from. Yeah. She just like went really badly. Yeah. Like,
crazy, right?
She put on like seven kilos.
Yeah.
Like the week after she stopped dieting. Yeah. And she had to go get counseling. She had to go get nutritional and psychiatric counseling. Had to get on medication. Yeah. I think she spent like something like 18,000 pounds.
Yeah.
To try to get fixed.
She said that, so they got her photos, her before and afters from the 12-week transformation. And then she flew from, I think it was like London to America, and her feet swelled, like the bottom of her ankles and her feet swelled. And then she said, and then it just like everything just started to swell up her body and to the point where she was holding so much fluid. And then she just put on, how much did you say? Like,
oh, she put on a ton. I can't remember.
Yeah, like really years. Quickly after. And she just could not budge it. Like, she could not move it. So she just like blew up and then couldn't, it took her so long to try and get it off. But they took her transformation photo. She was on the side of a bus in Hong Kong. But
the thing is, like, I'm not opposed to super low calorie diets.
No.
And I think people need to get it out of their head that everybody needs to, like, there's this new wave. You should be able to eat 3,000 calories and lose weight. But again, it's all these Insta famous people where they're training like 4 hours a day and all they do is eat, sleep, train, and poo. Yeah. And if you don't have that type of output, you have to be reasonable with how much fat-free mass you actually have. Yeah. I had a lady who was on 900 calories for 13 months.
Yeah.
And the reason was she was 102 kilos. And when we got her down into the 70s, then we pumped her calories up to 1500. You have to be reasonable with... Everything has to be based on how much fat-free mass we assume you have.
Yep.
If you have a lot of food on board, you don't need to bring in a lot of food. You just need to bring in the cofactors.
But even if you don't, for example, my wife Jess, she's going to the UK in a few weeks, so she needs to diet, right? But she's tiny. So her calories, if she wants to diet, are around sort of 1300-1400. She has a really sedentary job. She can only get to the gym a couple of times per week. And she's really short and doesn't weigh a lot. So it's like, you just can't eat that much food, Jess. Yeah. That's just what it is.
It is what it is. And the industry is now getting this point where it's like, you can't put people on 1,200 calories. Well, if I'm training a woman who's 47 kilos and her fat-free mass is like 37, 38, yes, I can. She simply doesn't need that food. If she's not training, you know, 5-6 days a week for hours on hand and her steps are at 3,000 a day, she doesn't need that much food.
Yeah.
We need to be reasonable with, you know, we don't want to starve people unnecessarily, but we want to be reasonable with how much food people can actually handle.
Plus, yeah, how accurate they're being. You know, most people like to give themselves maintenance breaks every weekend. And it's like, all right, well, let's go back down then. You know, it's like, oh. So how, in terms of, it just came up, I just wrote it down, in terms of rates of muscle gain. I saw Eric Helm bring something out years ago about like, once you are an advanced trainer, like your rate of muscle gain is exceptionally small, from like a pound to 1 pound per year. It's quite depressing, isn't it?
I wouldn't say that low.
Hard work.
I think that's what his paper was. I think that's what it was.
I mean, it depends. With Dianabol, anything is possible. Dianabol and Jesus.
We're gonna go no steroids in here. If you want to hear Luke's steroid podcast, we can
link it in the podcast fire.
It depends. Well, it depends what we're talking about too. Are we talking about dry muscle weight, or are we talking about weight? Because those are two different things, right? Because
muscle,
just dry lean. I don't know. I'd have to look into it. Mm. I would say if you're at that extreme level where you've put on so much that you're above what would be considered natural weight, which anytime we lift weights, you're creating an unnatural stimulus that's going to drive your lean body mass up higher than what's pretty much considered evolutionarily beneficial.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. At some point your body's going to go, yeah, fuck off. I'm not doing this anymore. So it's going to slow it down because you're already above the threshold of what you were designed to do anyways. Mm. I can't give you a good number. I can tell you when you look at kind of those first couple of years, it's not unheard of to put on about 6 kilos for a year and just dry muscle weight.
How good's that?
So it's good. Yeah, this is a newbie gains, right? But
Train, stop training. Yeah.
But again, that's just the muscle tissue component. Yeah, yeah. But then you also have water and glycogen and all the other things that you bring up. So you put on, 10 kilos in a year, 12 kilos in a year, 6 kilos of that about. And you start looking at 125 grams a week, maybe is a pretty good estimation if the stars and the moons align and Mercury is in retrograde or whatever. And then after that, it starts to slow down significantly. But people need to understand too, if you're going to do this long term, it is going to slow down. So you have to be careful that you're not focusing on the scale in that way. Because women will use the scale a lot for their self-worth. Are they too heavy? Whatever. Guys will do it the opposite way. If I'm bigger is better, I got to put on my gorilla suit. So they'll only use the scale and they'll end up like having all kinds of complications from getting overly bulky that direction and unhappy with the way their physique doesn't look clean to them. Right. But I think with that is you really should have other things you're focused on as well. That's where strength goals matter. Because when we train people, almost always we'll ask them, give me 3 goals. Because everything I do is highly specific. Everything. It takes me forever to put protocols together for people because I'm taking into account every little thing that you probably wouldn't even know you needed to take into consideration. So I'm looking at what's your physique goal? I want specific physique goal. Do you want to lose weight? How much weight do you want to lose? What body fat percentage do you want to get to? Where are we at now? I want a strength goal for a couple of different things, and I want a conditioning goal. Right? And if you don't have a conditioning goal, I'm going to base that on your metrics. Like how balanced is your anaerobic and aerobic system? Let's test that. And that'll dictate if you do conditioning or not. But a lot of people that go into it, they go into it just for a physique goal.
Yeah.
Most people that will train, they'll come in because they want to be less fat. If we can start focusing more on performance metrics, that gives them something else to look forward to. And it also in those weeks where they might not change physically that much, I haven't lost any weight. Yeah, but you put 10 kilos on your bench.
Yeah.
How about that? That gives them something else to focus on that's more productive than just focusing on the way they look on the outside.
Especially for general population and women who've never really strength trained before. It's super empowering.
100%. And, we've gotten to this era now. When I first got into the industry, like women didn't go to the gym. You would only see bodybuilding women in the gym. You would never see just regular gen pop people. And, women aren't supposed to be strong, blah, blah, blah. It's all a bunch of bullshit. Now women want to get strong. They actually want to get more than just getting one chin up. Cause that was always the metric. I just want to do a chin up. Now they actually want to do a double body weight squat, 2.5 body weight deadlift. They actually are getting these cool, gnarly strength goals that traditionally were masculine, but now they've become masculine and feminine. And I think it's really fucking cool.
I have a hypothesis with females and males with a push-up, for example, or a pull-up. So I use the push-up example. So you played sport when you were a kid, right? Do you play sport when you were younger?
Yeah.
All right. So every time I was punished from when I was 5 years old, I got told to do a press-up or go for a run.
Press-up.
Push-up, whatever you want to call it. But every time a female is punished, for doing it, they'll either do like a jumping jack or they'll do sprint. So over time, like over 20 years, you build up so much more volume. Does that make sense? Volume of pressing volume. That has to be something, right?
I heard, and I've never looked into this, so I probably shouldn't say it or quote it, but I have heard that females have a lot less androgen receptors in their upper body than their lower body.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why we have such a discrepancy between upper and lower body strength in ourselves, but also in comparison to males. But again, have not looked into that. It's probably worth looking into. To see if it's true.
We all three of us just look at you for the answers.
Well, the thing is,
I remember telling him, and he's like, I've not heard of that.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'll say this too. Men and women are built differently because we're designed to do different things, right?
Yeah. You can't say that anymore.
I'm going to say it. I don't give a shit if it's unpolitically correct or not.
Anything with a Texas accent, you get away with
it. Y'all.
Yeah, but I mean, there are, vast differences in upper and lower body strength between men and women. But people put way too much emphasis on the hormones anyways. They put way too much emphasis on, they put too much emphasis on their testosterone and not enough on the work ethic and just getting the shit done. Because women can put on a ton of muscle. They can put on a ton of strength. So I'm hypogonadal. I can't, You know, if I walk in, I went to a doctor the other day, and
that's why he's a crier.
I was telling her my secrets.
He's a hugger and a crier, and that's probably why.
She's a liar. But I went to see this doctor. I had this chronic like throat thing going on. I couldn't figure out what it was, so I went to see this doctor, and we were talking. He goes, "Do you have anything else? Here's some amoxicillin, some other things, blah blah blah." And I'm like, "Yeah." I said, "I think I need I've got low testosterone." He goes, "When was your last test?" I go, "I took it in September, and it was chronically low." And he was like, "Have you taken any steroids?" I'm like, "Well, not in the last like couple of years." I go, "But you know, I probably need to get on TRT, but I don't want to go the underground route because I don't want to get, if I get busted, I get kicked out of the country." Mm-hmm. Right? So I can't do anything illegal. So I'm trying to find a doctor. Well, I walk in, they're like, same thing he said. "I don't think you need testosterone."
Yeah, yeah.
I just told you that my testosterone and my bioavailable testosterone was really low on a lab, and you're telling me I don't need it?
Because you're big.
Because
yeah.
I'm big.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they still and think it's just about muscle.
He's tiny compared to what he, yeah. like this is big in comparison to other people, but small in comparison to what he used to be.
But the thing is, like, you can still have low testosterone and build muscle.
Yeah, they don't have no testosterone either, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're going to have some testosterone. So the guys who think that the testosterone is the reason they can't build muscle know that you're not building muscle because you train like a pussy and you drink too much and you don't sleep enough. That's probably why you're not putting on any muscles, because if I can get a girl to put on 4 or 5 kilos of muscle in a year, they have fuck all testosterone. What's your excuse now? Mm. Right. But I think people need to put more emphasis on what they're doing in the gym, training hard enough, and then also recovering harder than they train.
Yeah. This goes on to my next topic. Perfect segue. I tell you what. Okay. So building muscle, then basic sort of principles that we know, but I obviously want to hear some of the stuff from you. If there is anything else that you've seen through experience, obviously one of them is maybe muscle protein synthesis, maybe looking just nutrient timing. I suppose that's where the nutrient timing myth comes in with more meals. And something that I see is with like our morning trainers. So people train pretty hard here, and they'll come in at 5 a.m. and they'll smash a session, and then they'll fast till like midday. I'm like, it's probably not ideal. No. Ideal time to fast, right?
Right.
But then there's this anabolic window that we used to believe in probably a little bit more than what we do. You know, before I would even finish my last set, I'm like, supping a protein shake down. People, I think the research is like 1 to 3 hours, but I'll still have something within that first hour, like,
1 to 3 minutes for James.
Yeah, desperate.
Yeah. But okay, so here's kind of my take on that. All right, so is there a magic window? Yes. Is it larger than we traditionally thought? Yes. But there's a big window of putting carbs in the right places and turning carbs in the right things and also shuttling amino acids in the right places. And basically cutting down on catabolic rates and increasing muscle protein synthesis. Now, how much does that matter? It depends on your viewpoint. For me, if I'm training four sessions a week, let's say 4 sessions a week, and let's say 10 years, right, that I'm dedicating to this, and I delay my feeding window by 2 hours, I've just lost out on like 14,000 something hours of recovery. When you look at it like, if you take a big view on it and not try to micromanage it, those little things may add up, especially if somebody's natural and they're not taking any gear. And it's the easiest fucking thing you could ever possibly do is to just drink a protein shake after your workout. Like that, all you have to do is put powder in a bottle, put water in there, shake it up and drink it. Like, I don't even know why people argue about that anymore. I think they're just doing it just to be contradictory. You know, and you've got people saying, "Oh, it doesn't matter. Protein timing doesn't matter. You just need to get all your protein in a day." Well, looking at the research, it does matter, yeah. Especially if it's hypertrophy, because you're going through the ebb and flow of muscle protein synthesis breakdown. And so, you know, you have your protein shake. Let's say you train. Training is causing muscle protein breakdown, but it also stimulates a muscle protein synthetic response after it. And then you have a little bit of carbohydrate, a little bit of protein that's going to amplify that. And in a few hours, that's going to go back into muscle protein breakdown. Probably a good idea to have another, at least some protein, if you're serious about gaining muscle really fast and being really consistent with it. You probably do want more meals.
Yeah.
Especially if you're eating a lot of calories anyways, because you probably want to divvy up that energy over more frequent feedings.
Yeah. Everyone should be getting at least 4 feedings.
I think so.
Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and like you said, that
additional shake.
Yeah.
What about refractory periods? Because like, I think back in the day, I think a couple of things I read was like 2.5 hours, like minimum 2.5 hours, probably putting it towards 3. But now people are like, oh, just keep eating protein. Because like sucking amino acids, for example, right. It's like if you need that refractory period of 3 hours, but in between every protein feed and you're sucking on amino acids or BCAAs, would that cause an effect? If anything, you would say you'd be losing gains, wouldn't you?
I don't know because sometimes experience shows you different things than what you see in the literature.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I remember, I cannot remember who told me about this, but somebody was talking about like amino acid pulses. And I think it might have been me talking to Dr. James LaValle about it. And so I decided to try it. And so I started drinking lots of essential amino acids between meals. And then one day, this is when I was still one of the head coaches at Pelican Group, and I walked in and one of the girls that I worked with, she goes, "You look really big." And I'd only been doing this for like a week. And I walked in, I was like, "I feel big." I do.
I'm Batman.
You're like, "Thanks."
And I'm walking.
I can't believe you didn't marry her.
I'm walking through the gym and I'm like, "Fuck, I'm puffed." Like,
yeah, yeah.
Why am I so puffed? I went and got on the scale. I'd put on like 12 pounds in a week.
Yeah.
Through doing that protein pulse, but a lot of it was just bloated water shit.
Yeah.
And I was really uncomfortable. I didn't feel good. And then, you know, I didn't feel like my food was being processed that well. And so I stopped doing that. But I think for somebody who might be really ectomorphic and really skinny and has a hard time putting on weight, that might be a good strategy for them. They probably have a hard time building muscle anyways. Mm. But for somebody who's more mesomorphic and endomorphic, it's probably not a great strategy for them. But yeah, for me, it's just eat foods. Just eat your food and eat often.
Yeah.
But it depends too. And if you're looking at muscle building versus weight loss, I like intermittent time-restricted eating for fat loss just because I find for most people, if they can get through that eating, that non-eating window, that fasting window, and not have issues like reactive hypoglycemia or hypoglycemia, and they can get through that, they tend to feel more satisfied when they can eat 2 or 3 meals in a, say, a 6 or 8 hour window because their meals are a lot bigger, especially when they're getting down to low calories. You get somebody who's eating like 1,500 calories for a guy, you know, am I going to eat 500-300 calorie snacks or do I just save it all up for two or three big meals at the end of the day?
Yeah. I'm not anti-fasting. It's something I'll use. It just depends when they train. That's sort of the big one for me. If they train in the morning, then I am anti-fasting. I just don't think we should be doing it. Oh, sorry, we can make up a time-restricted window in the middle of the day, if you want to call it that. But for PM,
Yeah, I think if you're going to do that and if you're going to train in the morning, that's where timing probably makes a big difference. You probably want to maybe have a little bit of something before you train. Maybe even it's just like 15 grams of carbohydrate, so something
like
that.
Or something like
that. Have a banana, a little bit of juice, just something to get your blood sugar up a little bit. And then maybe have your protein shake after that and then go back in your fasting after that if you want to.
Isn't there something around women it's more important, I haven't looked at this, more important for females to eat pre-training than it is for males? Have you heard anything there?
I don't know.
You've heard about, maybe it wasn't you, but I have heard, and again, not looked into, not confirmed, that we have to be a little bit more careful with fasting due to us not having as many androgenic hormones and we don't have that protection from them. Didn't I hear that from you?
No, I don't know.
I think I've seen Stacey Sims post something about that.
I don't know who that is.
We don't know who that is, Sean.
And this is the problem. Like what I've just done twice now is just passing shit on without ever looking into it. And just like, I've heard this and then believing it. So I should probably stop.
It's the next one.
Facts.
But I mean, well, at the end of the day, it's probably a moot point because if you're trying to lose body fat,
you're not in a deficit anyway.
What?
Because you're just eating off your body.
Yeah, that's a weird concept I came up with. Is you're not actually in a deficit unless you're starving to death.
It's just what you consume is a deficit. Yeah, your body makes the balance up from
you've
your
got
fat stores.
Exogenous food you're eating now, you can calories. You've got endogenous food that you've eaten before you can process. You're not, if you think about that, you're not actually, if you got all the cofactors, you're not really in a deficit just on paper. Because your body's going to make that up with the body fat you're trying to get rid of. Now, once you get to the point where you're really lean, now you're in a deficit because now your body's starting to tear itself down from eating muscle and bone or whatever because you're now starving to death, which is if you want to be a body, if you want to be a bodybuilder, that's what you're doing.
Yeah, it's taking it to another level.
I was watching Chris Bumstead. He was when he was getting ready, I think, for the Olympia.
Yeah.
And if you want to be a bodybuilder, cool. Go watch some of these bodybuilders when they're month out, 2 months out, and look at how haggard they look and how tired and miserable they are. He looked in the face, he just looked terrible. Yeah. And he's talking about how he's doing like 2 hours of cardio a day and eating 1,600 calories. I mean, this dude's 105 kilos.
He's a big man.
Yeah. And that's controlled starvation. That's what it takes to win a bodybuilding show these days at the high levels.
Ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. The size of them now is just like fascinating. Calorie surplus, if talking muscle building. How big are we talking?
You don't need a huge calorie surplus.
It's pretty small, right?
That's you can gain size in a deficit. If the deficit isn't too big and your protein's pumped up, they made that pretty clear. It's not the most optimal. You're talking more of a recomp, but people put too much focus on the calories. Yeah. You need sufficient calories to train. You need sufficient calories to run your body. But you don't need a ton of extra calories to gain muscle unless you just want to get fat too. And
Just a big bulk.
Like these dirty bulks. Yeah. I mean, what's the point? At some point, you got to pull that off.
Yeah.
So you're basically just spinning your wheels a little bit, doing the old Lee Priest method.
And there's no huge benefit to having more body fat.
No, not really. Not really. I mean, there might, if you're, let's say you're 5% body fat, there might be getting the 10, 12, 13, 14 is probably going to be better physiologically. But there's no benefit of being 20, 23, 24%. Mm. Dr. Darren Willoughby talked about this at Swiss in 2015. He did a lecture, biochemistry of hypertrophy and fat loss. And he said, look, calories are not your driver for gaining muscle. Protein is.
Nitrogen, yeah.
Lifting and protein. He goes, you don't need that many calories above maintenance. You could even eat at maintenance. If your protein's high enough and you're training hard and you're recovering well, you're going to get big. That's the fact. If you start adding 1,000 calories extra, you're going to get big, but it's not going to be the bigness you're looking for.
Mm. Obviously, we've got things like sleep and hydration, but I don't think we need to touch on too much. Hopefully, everyone knows the importance of that by now. We've done some others. What about mind muscle connection?
For me, it's super important.
Yeah,
super important. A lot of that has to go with understanding technique and having more intent. I think it's more important for beginners than people who are more advanced.
Yeah.
If you're advanced, you need more mind muscle connection. You're still a beginner.
Yeah.
Right. That's where I think like Kasim and some of the N1 stuff, getting in those certain positions and being very intentional about how you're lifting and really focusing on a very certain specific area is really good in the first early stages of your training. Once you become more advanced, some of that stuff I like if you have holes in your physique, but at the time where you get becoming really advanced and elite level, anything you do is going to work. Mm. You've basically laid down the foundation of if I bench and keep getting stronger, everything's going to get bigger.
Mm.
Right. So, if a lot of people focus more on getting stronger and really basic fundamental stuff, they would have a lot better physique. It'd be more well-rounded.
Because was it Generation Iron a few years ago with the bodybuilders, that guy that was always in the lab, like working with EPs, and then there was that other guy just that rode horses and just fucking picked up shit, just like threw shit around.
Yeah.
And it was always the battle between those two, old school v new school.
It's with everything though. You like, even when we were talking about the pinch, like when you're talking about how now people are saying, you know, you should be able to lose fat off 3,000 calories, like the pendulum always swings from one way to the other. Like the answer is usually somewhere in the middle. It's like a blend of like the perfect balance of everything is where the answer lies.
Yeah. And like with training, a lot that the big thing now is move the bar as fast as possible. You always want to explode the bar off. Okay. Because, you know, we want to look at force production. So we want to have, you know, enough mass and we want to accelerate it really quickly. When you look at bodybuilding physique, we know it's undeniable fact that tension creates a hypertrophic response. I'll sometimes tell my clients to slow their concentric down to 2 seconds. And they go, well, I thought we were supposed to explode this off the chest. I'm like, yeah, you can. You could work on faster acceleration, but that reduces your time under tension.
Yeah.
So you might need more volume doing that. if you just slow it down and say moderate mass, moderate acceleration, keep the muscle under tension longer, you are reinforcing that mind-muscle connection, and you're also digging deeper into keeping the muscle contracted for a longer period of time. You just don't want to get crazy on that, start doing the old, what's the super slow training where they're doing 10-second concentric and eccentrics. But like if you put a 3010 or a 4010 on somebody's tempo, if you put 4010, it's always going to be 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
And if you put 1, they're going to go 1.
Yeah.
No, I want 3 down and squeeze 1 up. I don't want you to throw the bar off your body. I want you to squeeze the bar up, because anytime you start accelerating the bar quickly, you're inherently going to be using a lot of stuff you're not intending to use.
Yeah.
So for bodybuilding, if we're looking at, we're using targeted training, we want to target the muscles that we're trying to target, not just move through movement centric only stuff. We need muscle centric stuff, which means you need to be dialed in, focused. You might have to slow down the tempo a little bit to dig into the areas you want to dig into. Mm.
Do you find that, big differences when you're working at training volumes, whether this be for like male and female athletes, whether we're pushing for strength or just hypertrophy, that you have to take a different approach between like either sex? Because I know like with elite CrossFit athletes, for example, the top female athletes tend to be able to produce higher reps, more reps at higher percentages of their lifts, whereas males have a, like once they hit their 90% of anything, they're only hitting like 2-3 reps, but there tends to be a bit of a bigger jump between their 1RM, whereas the top female athletes can do like sets of 10 at 90%, but then they've only got that little bit of a jump between their 1RM.
Yeah, so if you look back at what we've kind of experienced, has showed us that women tend to be more neurologically inefficient than men, so which probably comes to some of that, the strength discrepancies. So men tend to do less reps at a higher percentage than women. Women also tend to buffer things better. So women tend to be pound for pound a little bit better at endurance stuff. But then men can, a lot of times men can override that with better running economy by just simply being stronger, having a better power to weight ratio. So sometimes we may skew the rep ranges a little bit. So if I give a guy a 5x5, I might give a girl a 5x7 instead to kind of accommodate that difference. But training age also, advancement in training also neutralizes some of that. So when you start getting into the higher training age, that gap starts to shorten itself down. It's not as broad as it used to be. But you're also a product of how you train. So if you're a woman and you trained with higher rep schemes because of that offset, you get better performance the way you train it. So like I'll give you an example. When I was still a competitive powerlifter, I had a buddy of mine who could bench 405 about 12 to 15 times, but he couldn't do 425 once. Mm. And he told me that. I was like, no way, bullshit. I mean, this is like 20 years ago. I'm like, no way, let's go to the gym. So we put 405 on the bar. I get maybe 3 or 4. He pumps out 15 solid reps. We put 420 on the bar. He lowers it down, completely staples his ass. But he only lifted in that 10 to 12 rep range. That's what he constantly did. He never lifted heavy.
Yeah, right.
So that's how his specific training adapted him in a specific way. Yeah. And it made no sense to me, because you look at like one rep max continuum, it doesn't make any sense, because 12 reps should be somewhere around like 67 to 70%. Mm. So he should have been benching like 500 pounds, like 560, 570 something. He couldn't do one rep with 15 pounds more than that.
It's true though. He's seen it. I'm thinking about it in my own training now, and I've gone through sort of just blocks of hypertrophy around that sort of 8 to 12. And then when I go and do a test or go and test my one, it's nowhere near what I believe it should be.
Yeah.
It's fucking way lower. It's really depressing.
Isn't it like though that really dirty muscle fiber makeup test that you know of?
Like the Hatfield test and the Polycom test?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
like do your one rep max and put 85%.
Yeah. So the Hatfield, I think, is 80%, and Charles did one that's 85%. So I like Charles's version a little bit better, because it's that extra 5% makes a big difference. But what you basically do is you test your one rep max, rest 10 minutes, and then put 85% on the bar and see how many reps you get. So if you're getting, say, under 5, you're going to be more fast twitch and more nervous system dominant. If you're getting between like 5 to 8, you're a bit mixed. If you're getting more than 8, then you're going to be more slow twitch and probably not as well developed of a nervous system. And I find that to be fairly accurate. I had a lady once, raw beginner. Beginners will always lift they can't, a beginner can't tap into all of their, a good majority of their high threshold motor units. I think the last, I saw a study a while back that said most people that are beginning strength training can only tap into about 30% of their high threshold motor units. So they're never going to, they're not going to get that much benefit in the initial stages in maximal strength. Yeah. They're probably better off just lifting in functional hypertrophy, hypertrophy strength endurance. And then once they become more well-developed, then going into maximal strength because they can't express maximal strength anyways. Mm. So for me, you're almost wasting your time the first year if you're doing singles, doubles, triples, unless it's sport specific for something like weightlifting or powerlifting.
So say, again, this just come to me now. There's a little bit of a term. Back in the day, everyone used to say about doing your strength exercises first and then maybe going on to your accessory work or your sort of isolated exercises. But now a few people are going, hey, let's do... or isolated exercises first at high rep range and then going on to strength. Where do you sit there?
Well, I created...
Funny you ask.
Funny you ask. I created a system of that years ago.
Yeah.
We call it backloaded structural balance.
Yeah.
So what we found, I found that people who, let's say you did a front squat. I like front squat as overhead squat, front squat's great metrics for mobility, flexibility, and strength. Much more the back squat because you can... you can lever up a really nasty looking back squat, but there's less room for error with an overhead or a front squat. So let's say I have somebody do a front squat and it just looks like shit. What we would do is a lot of PNF and crack stretching and weighted mobility movements up front and then put your squat at the end of the workout.
Yeah.
What I found was we could pre-fatigue everything. They'd be weaker on the squat at the end, but their squat looked better and they could squat without pain. And then, so we would do that for a period of time. Then we moved what we call front-loaded structural balance. So we move the squat to the beginning when you don't need all the prep work to do the squat. And then you move all the stretchy stuff and the weight of mobility to the end. And then eventually you transition out of that into normal periodization, more specific periodization for like strength or hypertrophy.
And you just work more like RPE based over percentage than
I don't use RPE.
No.
I think it's stupid.
Yeah, go on, explain.
Because it's subjective.
It is subjective.
Subjective. Yeah. Like you ask somebody, okay, I want you, tell me when you have 3 or 4 reps left. They hit 8 reps. Oh, I've got 3 or 4 more. They do fucking 12 more reps.
Yeah, I think you've got to test it, right?
You can only use that stuff with people who actually know what a 10 RPE is. And same thing with reps in reserve. You can only use that stuff if somebody has worked an exercise to failure and understands what an RIR of 0 is, which is I stand up from the bottom of a squat and I have to dump the bar because I can't stand up all the way.
Yeah, it's definitely easier the more advanced you are to understand.
You have to use it with advanced. I much prefer to use bar speed. I use bar speed and I know if the bar is slowing down, you probably have 3 or 4 slow reps before you go to failure.
Yeah.
So I use that and I use concentric technical failure.
We've used RPE a couple of times. We've done a few tests here where we've done RPE and we've told them to then re-rack it. And then wait a second, then pick it back up and then go for maximal reps. And
yeah.
Some people are close. Some people are like 10, 20,
yeah.
10, 20 reps more.
Easily.
And then you're like, right, okay.
Yeah. You were selling yourself short.
Yeah. Cause I think like for beginners, I wouldn't use it, but I would, if they're more advanced and they know what it feels like to fail a lift, it makes more sense at that point. But you know, velocity will show you everything you need to know. If I see somebody's doing like a 3010 and like 1, 1, 1.5, 2, I know you probably got, if you get about a 2.5, 3 second concentric press, you're pretty much at a 0 to 1 RIR. And that's, or if the exercise starts to change to something different. So like you're pushing that bench press up and your ass is up and you're twisting around. That's no longer the same movement. We're done. Like you've got that was your 0 RNR. We probably shouldn't have done that rep because that's a rep you're probably going to get hurt on anyways.
I always find it quite funny that when people are going through these and they're going for an RPE or even if they're doing sort of velocity, like speed on the bar, they're like, they rack it. And I'll go like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, it's so hard. I was like, no, it's not.
It was burning.
My heart and your heart look very different. My heart was quick.
It burns. It's supposed to. That doesn't mean you're done.
I wish my heart looked like that.
I'll give you another thing on that. Like, I've never let anybody write my own programming. I've never had a coach. I thought about it and I was always disappointed. So I'd never let anybody do
Everyone's
it.
Everyone's too stupid, basically.
No, it's just that I always could design it better than they could.
Because then you put 3 bench press days in. That's it.
But But like recently, over the last month, I wanted to get back into Olympic lifting. And I'm like, look, I want to know, I want to learn how the Chinese do it. So I started getting trained under...
smash your knees together on the way up.
And under, what's that?
Just smash your knees together on the way up. Right.
Well, I started getting coached by the guy who owns Ma Chinese Weightlifting. And the way he does it and the way the Chinese do it is they work from their easiest stuff up front to their hardest stuff. So they basically, most of the programming will be, you might do snatch turnovers as like a prep. Then you might go into like a hang, like a power clean. And then as the weight goes up, you might do 9 sets of power clean from a hang. And then you go to like doing pulls, high pulls on box. So they do, you know, go from a level of what's the lowest amount of weight. Now, when you get to the top of that set, that should start, you keep increasing weight through the next exercise, and they'll do it that way. And then you might do your back squat, and then you might do an accessory movement. But these are like 2-hour workouts and just absolutely busting my fucking balls in the ground.
Should the Western people do what the Chinese do? The Chinese are a...
Bro, it's tough.
Yeah.
Like the first couple of weeks, I was sending to him, I'm like, dude, this is, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
I'm fucked. And he goes, you basically have to get through it. So yeah, after a few weeks I've adapted. Now I'm like, should I go to the 4-day a week? Can I do that? Cause I'm only doing 3 days and it's fucking me up.
Yeah. I'll bet. Yeah. It's hectic.
Yeah.
All right. We got some finishing questions. These are fast.
Oh, we can't be fast.
Fast.
Okay, quick.
I've tried to make them as I've took loads out and put them in, right? So, celebrity that you'd like to fight.
I don't want to fight anybody.
Yeah.
Who do you want to fight? John Cena has to be for you.
No, I wouldn't fight John Cena.
But you'd be like, who's who?
That's my doppelganger. No, I don't do that. Will Smith.
Okay. What? Really?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't beat him.
Kevin Hart, because he's short and he'd be funny.
I think you'd beat him up now. Most people want to be a man. You wouldn't fight anyone.
No, I don't know. I couldn't fight anyone if I tried.
Should be easier. Celebrity hall pass.
My first thought was Justin Bieber, but that's a bit weird.
That is weird.
Yeah, he's like a boy.
He's a man.
What's yours?
Man, I've never.
You've never thought.
Maybe
we can't be fast. You've never thought.
What's her name? Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Completely
the crazy
fair.
One. Fair.
And dress up like Harley Quinn.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's
like
it.
Like the crazy.
Well, next one was favorite fantasy. I'll go past that. Favorite meal when you're sick, hungover.
We can't be. You like Thai?
Mexican food or Thai? Food. Yeah, something greasy.
If animals could talk, which one would be the rudest?
Pablo.
This is personal dog.
Yeah. Or Chihuahua.
2 hours.
Cats for sure.
Cats?
For sure.
Cats are dicks.
Yeah, exactly. That'd be the rudest.
I don't know why people have cats.
Anyone cat person?
Cats suck.
They do suck.
Cats fucking suck. Yeah. They offer nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing.
The first thing you do when you wake up?
Stretch. Isn't like this.
I was going to say.
Not like get out of bed into a stretching routine.
First thing I do when I wake up.
You get up and you take your pre-workout?
I take my pre-workout and I put a little nicotine in. Yeah.
What's the dumbest way you've injured yourself?
Oh, boy, yeah. Okay.
Which one do you want? The dumbest.
Okay, so the way I hurt my back initially is I hadn't trained seriously for like 6 years because I've been traveling so much. And I got here and I'm like, okay, I'm going to get strong again. So I started, I was only deadlifting like 120 and squatting 100. And in 6 months, I was deadlifting 218 and I was squatting like 190. Mm. And then I had to go to Melbourne to teach a class. So we had just gotten Daisy. So we did a road trip back. Then I had to fly back for a sales conference and then back. So I hadn't trained again in like 5 or 6 weeks. Went to the gym thinking I could still lift that. And I didn't do any stretchy stuff, structural balance. Pulled 100 out, did a couple of reps. Oh, fuck, that was heavy. Why is that so heavy? It's nothing. Like, all right, I put 120 on, a couple of reps. I'm like, fuck, I should probably stop and do some split squats instead. Put another 10 kilos on there. I was like, I would never let a client do this.
Yeah, yeah.
I got into a quarter squat, my back went ping, and then I could barely walk for 2 weeks. That's probably the dumbest. That or the time I got into, I was doing front squats in no bumper plates, couldn't dump the bar, no spotter. In one of those old school squat racks. Yeah. that you can't drop the bar on because you'll damage shit.
Yeah.
And I lost it. I went into a lot of protraction and thoracic flexion, and I tried to get the bar back on the rack, and I tore my serratus for the first time.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's pretty dumb.
And then the only injury I've really had is I just broke my arm in gymnastics when I was like in class. I was 7 and we were doing the vault and we just had to like jump on the little springboard and like hop over and the teacher got me to demonstrate what the movement was in front of the class, and I fell over. I like just bailed on the other side and broke my arm in front of the whole class.
How old were you?
7 or 8. Jesus. I was like demonstrating to the class what to do. And
it was your time to shine. And that's what happened.
I fucked up.
You buckled. That's what happened. Yeah. It's trauma.
I mean, that's the only real injury I've had though.
All right, last one. What is the weirdest thing you have ever eaten?
I've eaten fish eyeballs.
Ugh. Ugh. Gross.
Yeah. You ate turtle.
I thought you were going to say a turd then.
Turtle.
I was like, wow.
Turtle. Turtle was weird. Yeah, that was
turtle
weird.
Soup.
Where did you even buy that?
Singapore.
So we go to Singapore and like, let's go to where the locals eat. So we go to this. I mean, it was like shady. It was, there's no way it would have passed any type of health anything. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm going to have turtle. Never had turtle before. Go to the shadiest shop, get the turtle. It's weird. It's gray. It's kind of slimy. Tasted really good. But yeah, that was weird.
How do they cook like
it was like in a soup
in the shell?
Yeah, it's like,
oh, I don't know.
Nah.
Well, I think shell is their spine, like it's not like a snail.
Oh, that's the maddest thing I've learned today.
It was
it was weird because I went in to get it and I immediately regretted it after I ordered it because she was like, the pot that it was in and all, and I'm like, oh god, I'm gonna get like hepatitis or some shit, but I'm gonna eat this anyways.
What else have you eaten though aside from turtle? We grew up on like pig's trotters, which I think is normal. That's because normal. I grew up on
is
it normal.
Is that pig's feet?
Yeah
it
might,
that's not normal.
Yeah, see, we
pig's
my dad
feet?
Would like
is that
bought,
a Friday?
Yeah, they and this, pig's they feet? Were, do you know what's even grosser?
I like hog malls.
But what's even grosser is like they were still hairy, like you'd have the hair on
that's
the
nasty.
But I loved them, but it was normal for me growing up. So now it doesn't seem gross, but I guess it is.
That's where your foot fetish comes from, like, is it?
my hoof fetish.
I think sweetbreads. That's not, to me, that's not weird.
What's sweetbreads?
A lot of people think it's like the thymus or the pancreas of a cow. It's fucking delicious.
Like black pudding? Have you ever had black pudding?
No, black pudding.
Yeah, that's all right.
I like black pudding. It's good black pudding.
Yeah.
British have the
black pudding. Is just like the blood of like a cow or a pig.
It's just... the blood of a cow. It's just the blood of a cow or a pig.
Like,
weird. Like liver king.
Super
basically
weird.
Liver king.
Where I'm from, this
would
wouldn't be weird.
Would you drink a cup of it?
How many beers?
Like, is it just because it's in solid form, like a sausage?
It's one of the things I won't, it's like pineapple on my burger. Like, I won't take it off. I'd rather it not be on that.
Yeah.
But if it's on my plate, again, I'm going to eat it.
Well, it's something that we would eat back home that you guys would probably find weird as menudo.
Never heard of it.
So it's like a Mexican dish. It's like almost like a soup, and it's got tripe in it, which I'm not a big fan
Tripe's
of.
Tripe's like shark.
Nah, tripe is like cow stomach.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought tripe was like a baby shark is called tripe. I'm pretty sure I'm right.
So there's certain like holidays where that's like a big deal. So if you have Mexican friends and you go over, you're going to have a bowl of menudo, but... like I don't like because it's a texture. It's like when you tripe is like eating a sponge. No. So the texture just...
No. You're not very adventurous with food, are you?
No.
I'm not. There's no way I would be anymore. Well, I never really was, but...
I've eaten a lot of stuff in Mexico stomach. That I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
You go and you get like beef fajitas and you're like, that doesn't look like any beef I've ever had. And then you realize there's no cats or rats anywhere in the neighborhood. You're like, I'm eating rat. That's definitely.
Lankamon, chickens of the cave.
Yeah. Luke gets the chicken feet at the
Yum chicken feet.
Nah. Oh, that's nah.
Yeah.
I've been there once and I was like, get him away.
Yeah.
This is disgusting. All right, awesome. As always, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I hope this happens forever. Every time I speak to Zoe, he's like, yeah, we'll come on again. I'm like,
yeah,
amazing.
Well, come on in.
Amazing. Keep coming. Please keep coming.
Yes.
Because again, our podcast Bang when you're on, you have a loyal following.
We do. We have a small following, but they're loyal.
Super loyal. I had heaps of messages from some of the people.
Oh, cool.
So it's amazing. So again, where can people find you? Where's the best place to go?
Our Instagram is musclenerds_health. Our website is www. Does anybody say the www anymore?
Not anymore.
No. It's very uncool.
Isn't it? Yeah. Oh. Musclenerds.net. NET. My accent. That's pretty much it. We don't really use Facebook too much, but it's just Muscle Nerds.
Nobody does anymore.
No, for Luke. He
don't
just posts
look
memes.
Up Luke Lee.
Just memes.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed them. All right. Thank you very much for coming on.